BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news from Ian Skelly.
The BBC understands that cuts to the UK's defence budget won't be as deep as initially proposed, following an intervention by the Prime Minister David Cameron. The Treasury had sought a 10% reduction, but the figure is believed to be nearer 8%. The Army is expected to have to cut personnel, although the Navy will get two new aircraft carriers. But it's thought the ships will have fewer new aircraft and the overall size of the Navy's fleet will be reduced. Schools in England are expected to be protected from the cuts to the education budget, but significant savings are likely to be made to the overall budget of the Education Department. The devolved governments in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland set their own education budgets. Labour has suggested that the £40 million the Scottish Government is planning to spend scrapping prescription charges from next year should be invested elsewhere, such as on hiring more nurses. Details of the policy will be set out at the SNP conference in Perth this afternoon. An entire Anglican parish in the Archbishop of Canterbury's own diocese has voted to convert to the Roman Catholic Church. Church wardens at St Peter's Folkestone in Kent say many of their congregation are opposed to women bishops. In France, further mass protests are being held over planned changes to the state pension. Blockades at fuel depots and oil refineries have caused hundreds of petrol stations to run dry. The Chilean president, Sebastián Piñera, is due to arrive in London, where he'll meet both the Queen and the Prime Minister. He's said to be bringing, as gifts, lumps of rock from the bottom of the San José mine, where 33 miners were successfully rescued to world acclaim. People who lost money when Equitable Life almost went bust 10 years ago have said they'll fight for more compensation. The government is preparing to offer them £1.5 billion in total. And the weather for this afternoon, there'll be some scattered showers in the east. Otherwise, it'll be a dry afternoon in most places with periods of sunshine and less cloud than of late. Generally, light winds too, but it'll be breezy in southeast England. And that's the BBC News and the weather. It's now 2:30 past one.
And so we join Catherine Bott now for the early music show. And the programme begins with organ music by Bach.
Thank you. Bach's Fugue in G Minor, BWV 578, played by the subject of today's early music show, the Dutch organist, harpsichordist and conductor Ton Koopman. He's one of the most spontaneous musicians on the Baroque scene. There's never a dull moment when Ton's investigating new repertoire, as I remember from working with him in the early 1990s. A couple of years ago, a review of the latest recording in his complete Bach Cantatas project began with the enticing phrase, Koopman's irrepressible enthusiasm and impish wit remain undiminished. But he's also a formidable scholar, and as you'll hear, keen to use modern technology to share the fruits of his labours with the world. When we talked in London a couple of months ago, he chose the music we've just heard as a piece that represented the young Ton Koopman. I asked him first about his earliest performing days.
I was a boy in a boys' choir, a church choir. So I learned as a boy of 6 years old to sing, and I still remember that, to see the organist playing with his feet and hand on a big organ, electrochromatic organ, I would say. So when I heard it later again, I thought, oh, not a beautiful instrument. But for me, that was a big dream to see someone doing that, a big genius, and I wanted to be like him.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in Zwolle, which is in the east of Holland. And Zwolle is still a beautiful old medieval town, a small town with some lovely churches.
And in Zwolle, was it easy to get a good organ teacher so that you could start becoming this man?
It was not too easy. When I was 10 years old, I came into the music school, which was for amateur musicians. And there was an organ teacher. I wanted to have lessons with him because he was the big organ teacher there. Lambert Quackel was his name. And I went every year to him to ask, Mr. Quackel, may I have lessons with you? And he looked at me and he said, you're too small, you cannot reach the pedal. I said, yes, I can, because I was, since I was 11 years old, organist in a small chapel. And when I was 14, I was organist in a real church. And still, at my 14th, he didn't want to give me lessons. He said, you're too small. And finally, when I was 16, he said, okay, now we can try. Bring something which you really can play well. And in the meantime, I had practiced organ a lot, so I could play a nice trio sonata of Bach for him. And he was a bit amazed about that. And so I had a few years lessons with him, but very soon I discovered that he was not the person to be able to learn me a lot. There was another teacher at the school, a better organist, but he was a piano teacher, and he was not allowed to give me organ lessons, but in secret he did that. And there I learned a lot. And then I went to Amsterdam to study at the conservatory and the university, and then, of course, things changed completely.
So by the time you went to university, you had already exhibited one great similarity with Johann Sebastian Bach, well, persistence and learning something in secret.
Yeah, that's true. The only thing what I didn't do is Bach walked 300 miles to Lübeck to see Buxtehude, and I'm not a very sportive person, so if I could take the bike or the motorbike, I always did that when I was young.
So you're at university, you've already demonstrated talent that has surprised your first teacher, and persistence. When did you decide that as well as being a virtuoso keyboard player, you wanted to direct an ensemble?
That came by accident. I started to study musicology and organ and harpsichord at the conservatory. So in Holland, that separated the two things. And I made my first little chamber music ensemble, Musica da Camera Amsterdam. And sometimes we made it a little bigger when we worked with a small choir. And that was really at that point with historical instruments, but very beginning, I have to say. And when we did sometimes a Bach cantata with a small choir, then I had to make it a little bit bigger. And sometimes the choir conductor said to me, I'm not going to conduct this because it's too complicated to give this. Why are you giving the entrance and I can sing? So that was the first start, but it was never my dream to become a conductor, which took a while. It was always by accident I had to conduct something because it was too big to be without conductor. And the first real occasion was a conductor of a choir in Amsterdam died, and the choir always performed Maria Vespers of Monteverdi. It was his great dream, this music, and they wanted as an in memoriam concert perform that. And because I often played continuo with him, they said, why not you conduct this? At that point, I was able to do 10 weeks every Wednesday evening rehearsal. I mean, I cannot believe it anymore that it was possible. So I could really prepare the work by learning it with a choir, who was an amateur choir. And then I created people around me. It was not even the Amsterdam Rockhawks at that time. It was before that. But there was Bruce Dickey already there. Charles Toot, the good people who are still top people in the early music for this kind of repertory. And I remember it was at the same time that I did a concert with Jordi Savall in the Holland Festival. Jordi was in the audience and we were already friends at that time. So it was a memorable concert, actually. For me, the first time to do Monteverdi, first time to do all the rehearsals, and really to stand as a first time as a conductor there.
Ton Koopman talking to me a couple of months ago. He mentioned meeting trombonist Charles Toot and cornetto player Bruce Dickey in those early years. Here's a recording of them playing with Ton and the Amsterdam Baroque Orchestra in a section of Bieber's Vespers in 32 Parts. This is the Dixit Dominus.
Thank you.
The Dixit Dominus from Bieber's Vespers, the Amsterdam Baroque Orchestra and Choir conducted by the subject of today's profile on the early music show, Ton Koopman. As well as being a conductor, Ton's a virtuoso keyboard player, so I just had to ask him which comes first in his heart, organ or harpsichord?
The one I don't play at that point. I cannot make a choice. That's the problem of my life. If I could have chosen to say, okay, I'm only conductor, I only play harpsichord, or only organ, it has been more easy because now I have to practice both instruments and do a lot of other things. And still I write, I teach, and professor at the university. So I'm enjoying very much life, but it's complicated because it's many things. So the day has only 24 hours, and if you want to sleep a little bit, then you have to organize yourself very well to make it nice and to use the time. No, I cannot choose. I enjoy to play on a fantastic, beautiful historical organ. I enjoy to play on a beautiful harpsichord. And it's different repertory. Sometimes it's the same repertory even. And if you would say, okay, now you have to stop at one of the things, would you stop them with conducting because you like both instruments? I wouldn't do that either. You can do different literature when you conduct than when you play. And when I conduct, I do even music like Mendelssohn, Schubert, even Schumann. When I play, I would never play that. Although a dream is still once to play César Franck again. The organ works of César Franck, the three chorales, is still something very dear to my heart. And I feel, which is maybe strange to say, that if I play organ, Baroque music on the organ, I feel I play much more romantic, that kind of music, than many organists who play romantic organ music play that music romantic. They are much more intellectual working with this music. And I would love to have once a go to see if I'm able to make out the organ, which is not an easy instrument to be fluent in that way, if I'm able to do that.
Talking of organs and harpsichords, what do you think a player can learn from playing very old instruments, an instrument on which Bach might have played, if there are any?
I think the instrument is the best teacher. The instrument, if the instrument is really in good condition and it's a beautiful instrument, it will tell you, don't do this. This doesn't work. This is not beautiful. And if you have good ears, you will directly say, I'm so sorry. If you play on a multiple choice instrument, you can do everything and maybe nothing sounds very bad. Nothing sounds very exciting. And I think the historical instruments really are a teacher. And I learned a lot by playing on them and still very often performing on that. In a few weeks, I play on the beautiful Dom Bédot organ in Bordeaux, an instrument which was reconstructed after many, many years. An amazing instrument for French music, of course. And to play der Bach is, of course, nonsense, but to play François Couperin, Clérambault, Louis Couperin, it's a dream that you will never be able to do that on a beautiful German organ from Bach's time. So you have to choose as well the right instrument for the right repertory. And it's with harpsichords the same. I worked for all my life together with a harpsichord maker in Holland, Kroesbergen, who now retired, sadly enough. And he made the perfect instrument for me, maybe because there was an exchange of ideas. I told him what I was looking for. He was able to do that. And then he made something and we discussed again. So the instruments we're using now are strong instruments, but very dynamical instruments. So you really, if you play louder or softer, the instrument will respond to that. And next to that, they sound beautiful.
Thank you. La Cotin, Baroque music on a late 20th century harpsichord. The composer, Antoine Forqueray, the maker of the instrument, Willem Kreuzbergen, in 1978. The player, Ton Koopman. Harpsichordists often also direct large ensembles, which raised a provocative question. Now, talking about the difference between conducting and directing from the keyboard, I've talked to many musicians for the Early Music Show about this, and it's fascinating to hear what different views come out. Some directors of ensembles prefer to bounce up and down from the harpsichord stool and direct while playing, and some absolutely don't want to do this anymore, want to either play or conduct. Where do you sit on this?
I'm sitting in the middle, as with many things. I like the idea of maestro al cembalo, or maestro al organo, because I think to be musicians with your friends and colleagues is the best thing to do. Normally a conductor is the one who said, what is wrong? And now they can say to you what you do wrong. You are part, primus inter pares, I would say. And that's the role I think a conductor should have. You should not be the dictator, but you should be the person who loves to make music and likes to instigate the people to do even better than they could do already. For some pieces, you have to stand up. If there's a choir and an orchestra, like in a Bach cantata, it's simply suicide if you remain sitting because you cannot see people. And so sometimes you need your eyes not to look at the basso continuo part, which can be sometimes difficult as well. And although I enjoy to be the percussionist of the group when I play basso continuo, I still know that using your hands and eyes is sometimes important. But if I can, I'll remain the player. And that's what I want to be. And I think officially, there's no place in early music for a real conductor who wants to be Karajan. There's place for the conductor who said, I'm so sorry, I have to stand up because the things will be much more easy together and better regulate, and we'll do a good job together. But as soon as I can, I sit down.
I saw a quote, young Andres Nelsons, who is having a wonderful success with the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. He quoted Karajan, saying, there are only two institutions in the world where you cannot have democracy, and one is the army and the other is an orchestra. But I can see that you don't really agree with that.
No, because, you know, it makes a big difference if you work with friends, like in the Emerson Brockerson Choir. Most of the musicians know without saying what I like. If you work, what I do, often with a modern orchestra, then the situation is different. And first, they are not used at all that somebody is playing with them. They start to be insecure. And the other thing, with little rehearsal time you have there, and to explain too much, it's simply not possible to do it. So I think to be maestro al cembalo, it only works if you work with really people who think the same way. And then when you talk about democracy, that's the other side. I remember there was only one time with the Emerson Brockers in the recording of the Bach cantatas, in a cantata where I said, we should do this quicker. And people said, no, the chromatism tells that it should be slow. And my best friend said, Tonya, I'm going to make a big mistake. And with this cantata movement, we recorded it twice and said, okay, judge it yourself. And then almost everybody agreed with me and said, no, you're right. Chromatism is always slow. But in this case, because it was the devil who is wanting to hurt you, but as a Christian, you are not afraid for that. So I think Bach put everything upside down. And so there was no problem. And he wanted to show that with this means of chromatism, you really could do something positive as well. And so people heard, and I think with two exceptions, they said, no, I think you're right. So we record it like that, because at some point people accepted that in democracy, still there needs to be somebody who takes decisions. And if somebody comes with beautiful ideas, with bright ideas, I should be stupid not follow that. And when you work with friends, you want to stay friends as well. So you try to make the best of all the combination of things. And at some point, we all accept that somebody has to take decisions. And that can be even in democracy.
Mr. Shaw,
Master, look on us with mercy. The final chorus from Bach's cantata BWV 63, performed by the Amsterdam Baroque Choir and Orchestra under the direction of Ton Koopman. Here's Ton on Bach's town of Leipzig. Bach is at home here. You feel him looking over your shoulder, keeping an eye on what you're doing with his music, and you want him to be satisfied. Well, Bach isn't the only composer that he wants to do right by. Handel's organ concertos, for example, offer some glorious opportunities for thoughtful creativity. Back to our conversation. You obviously love editing music.
Yeah.
And how much time do you have to devote to this?
I have to say that when I made the edition of the Handel organ concertos, the first place I made it for myself because I was going to record it for Erato at that point. And the same for the Messiah, we just came out. The same reason, I wanted to know myself, because everybody's talking about different stadia of the work. And it's always difficult, you have to read many things to know how and what. So I have a very good assistant, a very good friend, Jan Simons, a musicologist, who was before a pilot at the KLM. And after that, he was a very church organist. He decided to study musicology. So he's the richest student in Holland, because and so he said, if I can do work for you, please let me do it. And so he does the first work for me, and then we discuss together and we make the edition together. His name will be there as well. And for the Handel organ concertos, it's an easy work in a way, because the autograph is there and we have editions. But for the later part, it's much more difficult. And the non-opus numbers, it's much more complicated. And I wanted to know what is there, what are the sources. And then Breitkopf came and said, but we know you are making a recording of it. Are you willing to publish it? And so I did. And I love to do the work, but I have to admit, it's a lot of work and I want to do a good job as well. So I'm not going for many editions. I did a Buxtehude edition of a work where there was quite a bit to reconstruct as well, Das Jüngste Gericht, which I had to do anyway because we were going to record it. And then the work is nice to publish. But on this moment, the Buxtehude cantatas were recorded. We gave them to the Buxtehude Gesellschaft in Lübeck, where I'm the international president, to publish them on the web. So people can use the information which I found. The only thing is, if I took a personal decision, you won't find it there, because I think we should be correct and adding what the sources give and correct the mistakes and nothing more. And then everybody had to make up their mind.
So here's Ton Koopman playing Handel, once again accompanied by his own Amsterdam Baroque Orchestra. This is the fourth movement from the Organ Concerto, Opus 4, Number 2.
Thank you.
a movement from Handel's Organ Concerto in B-flat major, Opus 4, No. 2, Ton Koopman and the Amsterdam Baroque Orchestra. That's from a triple CD set of all 16 of Handel's organ concertos. Ton has a number of complete works recordings to his name. He's recorded all of Bach's cantatas, of course, and he's now working his way through Buxtehude's works. As you'll hear now, he's a passionate advocate for the man whom young Bach went all that way to hear. I was very interested to notice your being quoted as saying that Buxtehude, he's a dwarf between two giants. Well, he's not. He's perceived as a dwarf between the two giants, Schütz and Bach. Do you feel that you are on a crusade to rehabilitate him?
I think there are so many composers who deserve to be much more known. The German musicology, particularly the German musicology of the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, they decided that there were genius composers, Mozart, Haydn, they were already a little doubting about that even, Bach, Schütz, of course, but very few composers who were the main lights of the musical history. And so to make them high, big, you need to make the others smaller. And in Germany, in Bach's time and a generation before, many great composers, composers who during their life were maybe even more famous than Bach, think for Telemann. And so Buxtehude was one of those composers where people were even not interested if he was born in Denmark or Sweden or Germany, where Spita, the important Bach biographer, found in Uppsala an enormous amount of cantatas, but he was looking for the organ works because he felt for the organ works there Buxtehude was sometime equal to Bach. But for the cantatas, of course, Bach was the great winner. And because Handel, Schütz were the great composers, so Buxtehude became a Kleinmeister, a small composer, with, of course, less minutes of music composed than Bach did. And so you cannot call a composer only great because he composed so much. When we think for Handel, which for me is a great composer, but I mean, he composed so quick, and I think Bach composed so quick. I'm certain that Buxtehude composed very quick, that we lost a lot of his music. We know that from one of his successors, he said, you know, a lot of the music from my predecessors was only worth to put it in the fire and to get it a little bit warmer at home. What of Buxtehude cantatas is gone there into the air? We have no idea. And happily, the music of Buxtehude is mainly in Uppsala there. In Lübeck itself, we have one book, an important book with some autograph corrections of Buxtehude himself, but the main part went to Uppsala because there was a Treppelmeister, Düben, who loved the music of Buxtehude, and apparently he was not a good composer himself, so he needed to buy music of somebody else. So Buxtehude became court composer, sent every now and then autographs there. They were copied by Düben and then sent back to Buxtehude. None of them exists anymore. So happily it happened there. And it's interesting that Johann Gottfried Walther, the nephew of Bach, said when he was old and he needed money, he was ill and he couldn't work anymore. He said, you know, I'm owner of more than 200 autographs of keyboard works of Bach and Buxtehude. Of Buxtehude, everything is lost. We have only copies and mainly by Johann Gottfried Walther. So let's be happy that those people did. I remember we were the first to record his Memories Nostri. Now it's recorded several times. But at that point I had a feeling that musicians, conductors were more able to listen to music than to read music. Because of course to go to Buxtehude's works and then to decide what you are going to record, if you can only record four CDs, is much more trouble than to record everything. But happily I had done it because for Erato we recorded in the 80s already some Buxtehude. And including this Memories of Nostri, when the idea came after Bach, could we go on with Buxtehude where I started with? And the answer was to myself, because the record company Errata wasn't there anymore. Then I said, yes, good idea, let's do it. And we're now two-thirds on the way, and I think I found the last sponsors to help me to finish it. So I think in 2012 we'll have recorded everything.
Ton Koopman. Remember that review I quoted at the beginning of the programme? Well, from our lively conversation, it's obvious, isn't it, that the famous Koopman, irrepressible enthusiasm and impish wit continue to drive him forward to new discoveries. Let's play out with some of Ton's beloved Buxtehude as he conducts the Hanover Boys Choir and the Amsterdam Baroque Orchestra in the last movement of Buxtehude's Cantata 75, The Limbs of Christ. Let thy face shine upon thy servant, save me in thy mercy. The soloists are Barbara Schlick, Monica Frimmer, Michael Chance and Christoph Pregardien.
Thank you.
final movement from Buxtehude's cantata Membra Jesu Nostri in a recording conducted by Catherine Bott's guest, Tom Copeman. All details of the music in today's programme are available on the Radio 3 website, bbc.co.uk/radio3. And then follow the links to the Early Music Show page. Well, in tomorrow's programme, Catherine will be looking back at the music and entertainment which Alessandro Scarlatti and Arcangelo Corelli helped to put on for a special visit from Philip V of Spain. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 2 o'clock, and now a second chance to hear last Monday's lunchtime concert from Wigmore Hall. It's introduced by Sarah Walker.
Welcome to Wigmore Hall, where soprano Soyla Isakoski is about to perform a sequence of German, French and Finnish songs. Schumann and Duparc form the bulk of the concert, and we end with a pair of works by Toivo Kuula from the early years of the 20th century, Paimenet, The Shepherds, and Sutilo, The Kiss. But we begin with something a bit more familiar, Schumann's Liederkreis, Opus 39. It's a 12-part song cycle dating from the year 1840, Schumann's so-called year of song, and a very happy and productive time. The words are by Joseph von Eichendorff, poetry which Schumann saw as reflecting the soul of the world. And the songs cover themes such as the magic of twilight, woodland greenery, and the mystical sense of faith in life and God, beautiful imagery yet tinged with a certain melancholy. And perhaps the most famous song of the set is the fifth one, Mondnacht, a ravishing nocturne, as the poet describes a moonlit night where the heavens seem to have silently kissed the earth. Well, joining Soyla Isakoski today, we have pianist Marita Vitasalo. And here they come now, onto the stage here at Wigmore Hall to perform at Schumann's Liederkreis, which begins with In der Fremde, In the Unknown.
kennst mich gut.